I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Mary Oishi. She's a poet. Her new book is Spirit Birds, They Told Me. And she will be reading tomorrow, Tuesday, March 29th at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. She'll be introduced by our poet laureate, Joan Logie. And then after the reading, she will be in conversation with the wonderful author, Margaret Randall. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm honored.
Would you like, Mary, to start by reading a poem? Do you have a selection that you'd like to read for our listeners?
Well, I suppose I could do that. There's one that's, you know, I don't know if you know what the Tokaido is. It's a highway that runs between Tokyo and Kyoto. They were the capital cities. And one was the spiritual capital and one was the political capital city. And people would go back and forth on that highway, and there were 53 little towns along there. And the great Japanese painter Hiroshige painted a series of pictures of each of those towns. You know, back in the old day when they would carry the dignitaries up on their, and a little thing on their shoulders, you know. And so this refers to that. And now the Shinkansen, which, you know, who knows, I don't think that the recent disaster did any damage to that, the line between Tokyo and Kyoto. But it stops at each of those stops, which is really kind of interesting. And anyway, so this is called 53 Stations of Tokaido. And just as a background, too, my mother was a war bride. She married an American soldier during the occupation and came to the United States in the 1950s. And I was born here in the United States. So this is 53 Stations of Tokaido. Mother, slowly atoning for doing what you had to do, given what you saw when you were in your homeland, given what you had to give up to marry the enemy, given you could never go home again, given you were repeatedly betrayed, and after nearly 40 years in America, still died a stranger. Yet you stretch yourself from beyond to make amends, to bring me back to your mother breast, by bringing me back to the womb of what made you, by sending me an emissary from your war-gouged generation, whose heart even a nuclear weapon could not destroy. She assured me you loved me. She said you loved me so much, in fact, that's why I was so drawn to you, that your love yearned me into seeking it all the way across the continent. That's what I feel so strongly, she told me, with the conviction of a saint. I believed her then, I believe her now, because it's still reaching me across the divide between life and mystery, across the generations, calling my daughter to Japan so I would follow, calling their reporter to my door, calling me to return as more than tourist, but speechmaker, poet, hungry-hearted lost child, finding my way to the seed of me, ancient cherry blossom spawning place for half of me, always buried just beyond where I could see, only glimpses in books, in a few artifacts left behind, but always two-dimensional and fairy tale. Then to ride a bike down the raised paths between its rice paddies, for Fuji to preside over the actual horizon instead of lying flat and moot between the map, behind the glass, to be greeted in her language, touch her fabric, smell her rivers after a rain, ride her fast train, her Shinkansen, hurling down the ancient path on my way to Kyoto, with Hiroshige's 53 stations of Tokaido muffled over loudspeakers as stops along the route. Now not one memento of your Japan would be flat for me, not even on the thinnest paper. It is forever raised far more than bas-relief, those memories, mythical pageants, a pilgrimage to heal. Now that I am back home on the continent where you birthed me, then lost me, where even after reconciliation and death you are not done yearning me to your mother breast, you move one who loves me to give me her inheritance, to feel it, call it, make it mine. Hiroshige's 53 Stations of Tokaido, in an old silk crane-bound book, of the 1,000 cranes you were, you sent me a few engraved on its cover, When I opened its pages, I wept. This is my inheritance. A print of Fuji in autumn, another of Fuji in spring, flooded rice fields below. I hung them up right away. They bring back scenes for me, yes, but more, they bring me peace. Japan has come to visit me, the old one you remember. You have come with it, Mother, smelling of early 20th century silk.
Mary Oishi reading from her book, Spirit Birds, They Told Me. Now, you have such an interesting and in many ways challenging background, a lot of which comes out in the poetry. I'm assuming, I don't know if this is right, but that the poems are in fact drawn from your life, that there's a kind of distillation of the truth of your background in them?
Yes, the first section is about the fact that I was taken away from my mother when I was a toddler. And so whole first section is about my search for my mother and my Japanese heritage, which I was really severed from in a rather extreme way, in that the people who raised me were relatives of my father, and they the woman was in the Ku Klux Klan, so they were very racist. And so the second section, the first section is called 20th Century Silk, which I got from that poem. I lifted that phrase.
Right.
And the second section is called White Sheets, Heavy Blankets, referring to the Appalachian KKK. They were also members of a very small sect of, they called, the nickname was Holy Rollers, but the real name of the church was Pilgrim Holiness. So, you know, it was all about growing up with them. That's why it's called White Sheets, Heavy Blankets. And then the third section is more of my political poetry and my whole quest to shake that dogmatic and kind of brainwashing. I, did a lot of soul searching. And then I partly dedicate the book to my ninth grade English teacher who saved my life. And she's one of the main reasons why I'm such a strong believer in public education, because if I hadn't gone to a public school, I shudder to think what would have happened to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, dealing with not only being of mixed heritage and being taken away from your mother, but then being in a white supremacist world as a little half-Japanese girl, what was that actually like for you?
Well, you know, we lived in this small town at the edge of Lancaster County, and this town, a lot of people don't realize this, but the North was really pretty segregated and racist, almost as much as the South, or maybe more so in some cases. But they didn't have separate drinking fountains because they didn't allow black people to be there. The town that I went to school in would not allow people of color to spend the night in the town. I mean, actually, I wouldn't have been able to sleep in the town that I went to school in. But I lived in the township outside of town. And it didn't matter that my grandfather was the township supervisor out there, my white grandfather, because, I was constantly reminded that my mother was a Jap, you know, is how they put it. And it was a difficult place to be, because I couldn't go home and get consolation at home, you know. In fact, what she would tell me is, if she would see I was upset from being harassed, she would say, what's the matter? And she'd say, are they teasing you again? And I said, yes. And she would say, well, don't worry, Jesus won't let you have more than you can bear. So that was,
oh boy,
that was her answer. But, you know, but I had some good things, too, in that I had a lot of time in nature, because we lived in a really rural area. And then her parents were from the Appalachian Mountains, so we would go up there every weekend. And I would spend most of my summers up there with my her mother, who was, I have a picture of her in her KKK uniform, but she actually loved me very much. She just didn't realize that in that area, I'm known as the little Jap that Lily raised.
It's such a, there's such a strange, and you see this all the time, a kind of cognitive dissonance between just overt, crazy racism on the one hand, and then love of some person who is of the objectified and disliked race on the other. And you were living that.
Right, exactly. And then also taking in a whole lot of racist messages about myself, you know. But, you know, it's been a kind of quest of my life, and it's really amazing that over the years I ended up in 2001. I was a delegate to the UN World Conference Against Racism, and part of that is because of my lifelong work in eradicating that from myself. I had to do a lot of work and a lot of training. And I ended up being an anti-racism trainer because I do know how to speak to white supremacists. I mean, I can still see them as human beings, as just incredibly ignorant human beings. But you know what I mean? I still try to hold a space for everybody's humanity, and I think that's enabled me to get through life. So actually, it was a gift in many ways.
Now, your mother, whom you became reunited with as a young adult,
mm-hmm.
She lived basically in exile. She never went back to Japan, is that right?
Right. She never did. In fact, she didn't even keep contact with any of her family there. And her family was rather prominent. But it was such a shame, you know, dishonoring thing to marry the enemy, you know. And I spoke to a reporter from Yomiuri Shimbun, which is like their New York Times. They had an article about me a couple years back. And she told me that there were 40,000 war brides, and almost none of them ever went home. And many of them ended up, having a different image of what America was. And they would come back and end up in the hills of Kentucky or, you know, as my mother did in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and just, you know, absolutely hate where they were, but they had no choice then. They were kind of exiled. They couldn't really go back home. So
you were separated from her. What did she do the rest of her life?
She divorced my father a couple years later, and had three husbands over the course of her life. And I think she was incredibly damaged before she came here because, you know, her family was really prominent, and then, you know, she survived the firebombing of Tokyo when she was 17, and that's what the first poem in the book is about, that, and I think it damaged her. She had a radio show in Tokyo also, my father said, but, and her mother was a lawyer, and, I mean, they were, you know, her grandmother owned a school in Japan that emperor sent flowers to her funeral, that kind of thing. But I think my mother was really damaged by that. And she was an incredibly intelligent and charming person, but I think she was really wounded by that experience. And I think that's why she fled to the United States, basically. I think she just didn't want to be at the scene of the crime kind of thing.
Right.
And it was too hard for her. And her family lost a lot during the war. And so I think she just, you know, came here and then she ended up, you know, she had been in law school in Japan, but she ended up here. She was the first woman bartender in Oakland, because I guess she didn't have to, you know, she could just use her charm.
Right.
So I have an article from the Oakland Tribune of her being the first woman bartender.
Now, what was it like when you finally did reconnect with her as an adult? You changed your last name, I guess, from your father's name to your mother's?
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, from my married name. I was married, and after my divorce, I said, you know what? I don't really want to give my husband's family any credit. You know, because back in those days, you know, most women change their names. And so I thought, if I'm going to change it, I'm not going to change it to my father's name, because they were pretty people I didn't really want to honor either, you know, when they were so racist, you know. So I ended up changing it to my mother's maiden name, and that woke her up, you know, that I really did want to have a connection with her in my life. She thought I didn't want to, but I did.
And then
very much.
The last couple of years of her life, you actually got to spend time with her. And as some of your poetry recounts, you started learning things about her, even about this firebombing of Tokyo and all sorts of things that you hadn't known that were very important to you and that comes out in this work.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, my two brothers, who are my full brothers, did grow up with her. And they didn't even know about that. I mean, so once we reconnected, we had really, not only in person, but we sent back cassette tapes. I lived in Pennsylvania at the time, and we sent back cassette tapes several a week back and forth because she couldn't write English very well. So I have this trove of wonderful tapes of my mother laughing and talking and, you know, singing songs, and, you know, her sense of humor comes through, and just her personality, which was phenomenal. She was a wonderful person. And so fortunately, I have all of that, which is really great.
We're talking to poet Mary Oishi about her book, Spirit Birds, They Told Me. Where does the title of the book come from?
It comes from one of the poems, actually, in the first section, because there was this strange connection between birds. Like when I was sitting in the airport in San Francisco in the cafe waiting for the flight to Tokyo, the first and only time I went to Japan, you know, there was a raven sitting there right outside the window, just staring west, you know. And I watched him for the longest time, and I ended up writing that poem in that cafe. And then when I got to Japan, there were all these experiences with birds. You know, there were flocks of ravens, and there was some swallow that kept, where I was staying, he kept binking into my window with his beak every morning at about 5 o'clock and woke me up every single morning. And I was staying in an apartment where my daughter was teaching English, and so she was living there, so I stayed in her apartment some of the time, and she said that never happened, so I don't know what that was about. So I kept having all these images of birds, and I said, you know, it's just too much, you know, there has to be some kind of message in all of this. So I tried to find it, you know, and that's in the poems as well.
Your poetry responds to so many things. On a personal level, there's, as you said, growing up in this sort of crazy, racist, white supremacist enclave, also the horrors of sexual abuse and then losing your mother, and then this somehow remembering the firebombing of Tokyo of your mother, and then extrapolating out to oppression, war, the horrors of militarism. This is, of course, what a lot of people are dealing with through activism. What is the relationship between your art and activism?
Well, I think I've always used, I feel like the universe has always used my art to push me into activism, or to, like, be my way of doing activism. You know, like when the Iraq War first commenced, I got the idea that I was in so much grief I was just going to shave my head. And I sent out an email to some of my friends, and I said, this is what I'm going to do. Would you be willing to do it with me? And we all read a poem or a statement of conscience before we do it. And so I called it Peace Buzz, because I think if you name it something that sticks in people's minds, it has more, I don't know, just has more cachet for people. And then they'll show up, you know. And so we did it here at a theater here. And, I don't know if it certainly didn't end the Iraq War, but it gave the activist community a sense of re-empowerment, you know, where we could all come together and say, well, okay, even though what we did didn't stop the war from happening, we're not going to just be defeated and say, okay, well, then I guess activism isn't worth it, you know? Because I think it's important to keep taking your power back, whether it's abuse or you know, whether it's something on a large scale like an invasion of another country. I think it's really important that those of us who hold a space for life and everything, that we continue to stay empowered and not get defeated. Because it's a long struggle, you know.
I mean,
look how long it took to end slavery, you know, in the United States.
To the extent that we have ended it, but yes.
Well, yeah, it didn't happen overnight. So, you know, it's like I think we're so accustomed to everything being so quick. And we have to encourage each other to, you know, stay in it for the long haul. I'm sure the struggle is going to go on long after I'm dead, you know. So, but I have to, while I'm here, be on the right side of history now.
We're talking to Mary Oishi. Now, you dedicate the book to a number of people, including your ninth grade English teacher and Margaret Randall, who's going to be reading, who's going to be speaking with you tomorrow night after you do the reading at Collected Works Bookstore. Tell us a little bit about the importance of teachers and mentors in your life.
Well, like I said, my ninth grade English teacher, I sent in a poem to a national publication called Reed Magazine that went to high schools all over the country. And I did it quietly. I never told anyone because I didn't think they would publish it. And then when they did, I still didn't say anything. But my English teacher saw it, and she said, "Would you stay after class?" And so I did. And she said, "Do you write other poetry?" And I said, "Yes, oh, lots of it." She said, "Would you mind bringing it in?" I did my master's thesis on the publication of Emily Dickinson's work, and I'm very interested in, you know, in poetry. So I brought it in, and she gave me all these books. She gave me a book of Carl Sandburg and Emily Dickinson and E.E. Cummings and, you know, just all these people. Edna St. Vincent Millay, I remember that one. And she just encouraged me to keep writing. And so I feel like she saw a path that my parents dressed me like a little holy roller girl from the Appalachian Mountains, and she just saw past everything and saw what potential I had. And she was so kind to me and so encouraging that I just really feel like if she hadn't singled me out and encouraged me like that, I probably would, I don't know what I would have done, faded into the woodwork. I don't know. But and then Margaret just, I met her probably about 5-6 years ago when we both read at Duende Poetry Series in Placitas. And she loved my work, and she called a publisher the next day and said, "You have to publish this woman." And I didn't think I was, I mean, I published a poem here and there and everywhere, you know, a lot of different places, but I never put together a book because I was convinced that my poems were performance pieces, that they wouldn't hold up on the page without my voice animating them. I don't know why I thought that. But she just kept saying, no, you must publish because more people have to be exposed to your work than just the people you can read it to personally. So, yeah.
I would imagine that New Mexico, I wanted to know how you ended up here, but I would think that it would be a place that would be comfortable and familiar to you for many reasons, partly because there's so many people here dealing with both various kinds of oppression and war and nuclear issues, and also being of mixed cultural heritage as you are.
Yes, I feel more embraced by New Mexico than any place I've ever lived, and I will probably die here. And my friend Michelle Otero says, you know, it doesn't matter where you're born, it's where you plan to die. So New Mexico has really embraced me, and I think it is maybe because there is more acceptance of people of cultures other than the Euro-descended culture. And also, when I first got here, it was I lived so much of my life on the East Coast. And when I first got here and people would get a standing ovation, I used to think, wow, they must not know what good is, you know, because like in the East, you had to slay people for 100 miles to, you know, get a standing ovation. And here it's like they encourage everyone you know, at least in Albuquerque, it's that way. They just encourage everyone. It's almost like when you're trying to learn Spanish, you know, how the Spanish, native Spanish speakers will say, oh, muy bien, and stuff, you know, and they'll, like, encourage you, whereas the French will laugh at you if you don't, you know, if you don't speak perfectly from the get-go, you know. And so I came to appreciate that here in Albuquerque, and I think that I've seen so many poets blossom, and this is a great town for poetry, and I know I have a few friends in Santa Fe as well, so I know that there's a lot of poetry going on in Santa Fe and Taos and all over New Mexico, and that's, to me, that's a wonderful thing, because my ancestral DNA says, you know, yay, because, you know, in Japan, everyone was a poet, you know, at least during my grandparents' generation, you know, and so it makes me feel happy, because I think poetry is like a direct channel to God, if you will, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, and so that means that there's a lot of people here connected to spirit, you know, and it's encouraged, which is just a beautiful thing.
Mary Oishi is a poet. Her new book is called Spirit Birds, They Told Me, and she will be reading at Collected Works Bookstore tomorrow, Tuesday the 29th of March at 6 o'clock. She'll be introduced by Poet Laureate Joan Logie and Margaret Randall, and she and Mary will have a conversation at the bookstore afterwards. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Would you like to read one more, maybe slightly shorter poem?
Oh, sure. I was thinking, because of what's going on in Japan, that it might be good to read one of my political ones. And I could tell you how this happened. Shigeko Sasamori is a survivor of Hiroshima, and she was quite disfigured and everything from the bombing. And every time she comes to New Mexico, she stays in my home. She's kind of adopted me, sort of, you know, informally. Anyway, so she came here for a celebration of the first nuclear test at the National Atomic Museum. And she went to this big gala event, and they had to sit there and look at what they had done. Anyway, they gave her a pair of bomb blast goggles as one of the accoutrements of this horrible gala event. And anyway, so before she went to the airport, she said, she threw them at me, basically. She just threw them on the table. And she said, here's, they gave me these. I don't want these. You take them. They'll have a poem for you. And so after I took her to the airport, I came back and sat at the same dining room table and put these goggles on, and this was the poem that came to me. Bomb blast goggles. Even with these goggles and my eyes closed, I can see the bones in my own arm. The science is amazing. The science is amazing. The sun rose twice today, thanks to the Trinity, Truman, Groves, Oppenheimer. Alleluia. Alleluia. The science is amazing. E equals MC squared minus 140,000 innocents, Hiroshima. E equals MC squared minus 70,000 more innocents, Nagasaki. E equals MC squared minus 1 John Wayne, Nevada. E equals MC squared minus who knows how many Navajo uranium miners buried on the res. E equals MC squared plus Chernobyl plus Three Mile Island plus depleted uranium plus nuclear waste toxic for 144,000 years. Plus leukemia, plus thyroid cancer, plus prostate cancer, plus breast cancer, plus babies born without brains, plus babies born with major organs outside their bodies, plus, but why go on? Why add it all up? The science is amazing. All I can see is the science is amazing.
Mary Oishi from Spirit Birds, They Told Me. Thank you so much for being with us, Mary.
Thank you.